This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In this Radio EcoShock show, we find out the amount of carbon we can burn and still have a safe climate is zero. One Australian calls it code red, time for emergency action. Then we'll zero in on one of the global cities that will flood time and time again, a new scientific report on why New York City is going under. We end with a quick lesson from a wise gardener grower in Texas, how and what to plant in the coming times of heat and water stress as the climate warps far from normal. I'm Alex Smith. Get ready for Radio EcoShock. In a hospital, code red means a fire where the alarm signals and everyone's evacuated. For Australian blogger David Spratt, planet Earth is in a code red situation. We can't evacuate anywhere else, so we need a fast response to put out the developing fires of climate change. I've been checking David's work at climatecodered.org for a few years now. His emphasis on science and links to his sources has brought him a reputation as a leading voice for climate action. Where he seemed almost on the fringe with what he was recommending a few years ago, new science has proved him right too many times. Now Spratt says all the talk of a safe climate with a budget of carbon left to burn is a very dangerous illusion, and I've called him to ask him why. David Spratt, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
What was this illusion of a safe level of 2 degrees warming so often used by government reports and international climate meetings? Maybe we'll debunk that, but first let's get, what was the thinking behind that 2 degree target?
This is very ironic, but it goes back to 1975, or the first recorded use of this target, by all things, not a climate scientist, but an economist called William Nordhaus, in a presentation to the Cowles Foundation. And he said, look, let's look back over the last million years, and we seem to have had climates that are up to 2 degrees warmer than they are now, and they don't seem to have been too bad. So I think up to 2 degrees warmer than now would be okay. And that's where it started. And the problem is that that was a political statement, not a scientific one. The scientists always see it as a political target, and the politicians see it as a scientific target. And I think Nordhaus was wrong in his understanding of paleoclimate the last million years. There have been very few circumstances where we got to 2 degrees warmer than now, and for no sustained period. And as well, until 10,000 years ago, we didn't have human civilization. We wandered the planet. We ran away from ice sheets. We were not sedentary. As sea levels went up and down, we could shift. We no longer have those options. So it was a very optimistic target.
So if it's not safe, who is saying that it's dangerous, and why would anybody say that?
Well, I mean, it's just become embedded in the political process, the international process, as the target that we should go by. It was embedded a long time ago when it seemed a long way away and we wouldn't have to do too much too quickly. And now it's upon us. And it's sort of, it's become the climate policy paradigm. And I guess we'll talk about that more. But now there are two things which are really obvious. Most people involved in the political policy making no longer think it's attainable. And the science is increasingly telling us that it's too high.
Right. I mean, look, we're already seeing the Arctic sea ice melting, and we've just had recent reports that Antarctica, the glaciers there, are melting.
Yes, those Antarctic reports, I think, are really significant. I heard a climate scientist here in Australia talk about it last night, where we have two reports saying at the current level of warming, the oceans under those ice sheets where they extend into the ocean is now so warm that they're eating into those glaciers. Once they get past the rock that they're grounded on, those glaciers actually are below sea level. So water will flood in, and the leading researcher, Eric Rignow, has said they're now in unstoppable meltdown. And I think the climate community believes that's very sound research. 1 to 3 metres of sea level rise from those two glaciers, probably triggering the rest of the West Antarctic. So we're talking about 5 metres of sea level rise there, triggered by the current temperature of less than 1 degree. So that's just one really good example of tipping points, which perhaps 20, 30 years ago, the scientists may not happen to the 2 to 3 degree range, now happening under 2. 10 years ago, they thought Greenland would melt around 3 degrees. More recent science says 1.5 degrees plus or minus a bit. So the science is becoming more severe, and the safe zone is really being drawn down a lot from 2 degrees to it's 1 to 1 degree now.
So where do you live?
I live in Melbourne, Australia.
Right, okay. Because I'm thinking Sydney will go under.
Well, Australia is a very urbanised country. 80% of our population live within 50 kilometres of the coast. So we have a population which is very vulnerable to sea level rise.
Now, you have written about what happens if we don't make it. What does a 3-degree world look like?
This is a question because we as humans have no human memory of this because the last time it was 3 degrees warmer was perhaps 3 million years ago in a period called the Pliocene. We do have some records from that. There's actually a very wonderful book called 6 Degrees that some of your listeners may have read, published 5 or 6 years ago by Mark Linus, where he talks about what the impacts would be at each degree of warming. But we know, for example, that during the last ice age, it was about 5 degrees cooler and sea levels were 120 metres lower. We also know that the last time there's no ice on the planet, sea levels were 70 metres higher, it was 4 degrees warmer. And if you put those two figures together, you have to understand that in the long run, each 1 degree of change produces about 15 metres of sea level rise. So with 3 degrees warmer, we are talking about sea level rises in the tens of metres. We're talking about the Northern Hemisphere having no ice. In the Pliocene, there were beech trees growing in the transantarctic mountains in the Southern Hemisphere. Certainly at 3 degrees, the Amazon would cease to be a rainforest because there would be less rainfall and drying and more heat there. Forest fires, which are now once every 20 years, they think would be most years, and most of the Amazon would burn and come back as a dry forest, and that would release billions of tons of carbon into the air. So we're talking about a remaking, both in terms of sea levels and vegetation of the Earth's surface.
You know, David, I remember listening to a recording of a speech by John Schellenhuber, and it was at the 4 Degrees or More conference in Sydney, Australia, back in 2011. And Schellenhuber, he's one of the world's top scientists. At the time, he was a climate advisor to German Chancellor Angela Merkel. He said, there are a series of processes known to physics which suggest that the climate may not stabilize anywhere near 4 degrees warming. It may sort of bump up to 7 or 8 degrees above pre-industrial levels. It's hard to imagine. It was a chilling speech. Can civilization survive that kind of warming?
I had the privilege of actually hearing 2 speeches he made at that time, and he's a wonderfully direct scientist in the way he communicates. What he's saying is that on the present business-as-usual trajectory for emissions, we're heading towards 3.5 or 4 degrees of warming this century. But that doesn't include what are called long-term climate feedback, something that Jim Hansen from NASA talked about a lot. So things like destabilizing of the Arctic carbon stores, the ocean not taking down carbon dioxide as efficiently, the soils and the plants, for example, the Amazon not storing as much carbon dioxide, starting to see permafrost or methane clash rate coming out of the Arctic. So our normal emissions will get us 4 degrees, but if these feedbacks kick in, and they certainly will in the 2 to 3 degree range, we could see much more. And Sheldon Hoover was one of 2 scientists, and the other one being Kevin Anderson a few years ago, who said, if we get to 4 degrees of warming, we think our best expert guess is that the carrying capacity of the planet will be under 1 billion people. So that's a very stunning statement. Other people, James Lovelock said that many years ago, and more recently the presentation in England, Kevin Anderson said, I think 4 degrees is incompatible with the continuation of human civilization. So I think there's a widespread view that it's simply, we could not go on as we are, and obviously at 4 degrees of sea levels, when the end get up to 70 metres, that's going to drown most of human civilization. So it's a very dramatic scenario.
Now, coupled with this idea of a safe 2 degrees was the whole idea of a carbon budget, that we could still burn a certain amount of fossil fuels, you know, for a decade or two and be all right. What is this idea of the carbon budget? Where did that come from?
Well, look, that came essentially from a couple of very well-received papers in 2009 by Miles Allen and Malte Meinshausen, who's now a researcher here at the University of Melbourne. And they said there seemed to be a fairly linear relationship between the total amount of carbon put in the atmosphere and the temperature rise, which they documented. And then they said, if you want 2 degrees of warming, how much total carbon could you put in the atmosphere? And the answer is not one number, it's many numbers, because it depends on the risk you want to take of exceeding 2 degrees, because there's obviously quite a bit of uncertainty in the climate system about whether the terrestrial and ocean carbon sinks will maintain their efficiency or become less or more. There's the question of these long-term feedbacks, which is called climate sensitivity. In the end, if you double the amount of carbon in the atmosphere, in the short run you get 3 degrees of warming, but perhaps in the long run you get 6 degrees of warming. So these carbon budgets are associated with the probability of not exceeding a target. So, for example, in the IPCC report last year, and I have to say that so far humans have put 550, this is the first number, about 550 billion tonnes of carbon in the air. And they said, look, if you want a 33% chance of staying below 2 degrees, then you can have 1,500 budget. If you want a 50% chance, it comes down to 1,200. If you want a 66% chance of staying under 2 degrees, then it's 1,000. And then if we take gases other than carbon dioxide, because we're putting up methane and nitrous oxide and so on, then perhaps the budget is 800. So by different probabilities or risk, we've gone from 1,500 to 800. And remember, we've already put up 550. So the basic position was, if you want a 2 in 3 chance of not exceeding 2 degrees, the budget is 800, and we've already put up 550. So there's about 250 billion tonnes left, and we're putting up more than 10 billion tonnes a year at the moment. So that means, at the present rate, the budget would run out in 20-odd years. So that was what the IPCC said.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with Australian David Spratt, proprietor of the popular Climate Code Red blog. Well, that sounds okay, David. We've still got another 10 or 20 years to go on driving our cars and flying our planes. What's the problem?
Look, I think there are 3 problems with this. The first is that this budget of having 250 billion tonnes left has a 1 in 3 chance of actually going above 2 degrees. And we know at 2 degrees that the West Antarctic ice sheet is gone. Certainly our coral reef systems will go at 1.5 degrees. The Greenland will probably go, that there'll be sea level rises in the tens of meters. So we don't want to go above the target. People who work in risk management, for example, in building planes and buildings and so on, saying their risk or probability of failure is 1 in a million. You wouldn't get in a plane if there was 1 in 3 chance of it crashing. It is literally 1 in a million or 1 in 10 million. But we're having a target with a probability of failure of 1 in 3. And given the consequences over 2 degrees, that's obviously unacceptable. And if you look further at these carbon budgets and actually give the figures, if you said, we don't want the chance of going above 2 degrees to be more than 10%, then suddenly we have no carbon budget left.
And have we allowed in these budgets the carbon that we're going to have to burn just to produce enough food for the billions of people on the planet?
We've got this carbon budget left, but we have to remember that we're going to have ongoing emissions from particularly food production, that's methane and nitrous oxide, and also from deforestation for the rest of this century. And they did a piece of work published by the Proceedings of the Royal Society in 2008, and they said, let's make really optimistic assumptions about food and deforestation emissions for the rest of the century. Let's assume that the emissions per unit of output halve, that is, that the food we eat will only have half the emissions that it does now. And they ran their models, they had 18 different scenarios, and once you add in those food and deforestation emissions, 10 of the 18 scenarios, and this was 6 years ago, had no budget left for 2 degrees. So once you take in food and deforestation, whatever remaining budget is left is used up. And so for fossil fuels, we literally, even at this 1 in 3 chance of exceeding 2 degrees, we have no budget left. That's the brutal reality.
Well, you know we're going to want to eat. So if there's no more carbon we can safely burn other than that, what does that mean for society? I mean, we think we can't stop using fossil fuels today, this year, or even in the coming decade. So what are we talking about?
Indeed. Well, look, I think that we've been involved in thinking about climate change. I mean, there's a paradigm, there's a frame around which this is constructed, which is set internationally. Let's go for 2 degrees. We think that will be okay. Now, that's not okay. And we think we can achieve this by actions which will absolutely not be disruptive to the economy or the workings of society. I mean, both Sir Nicholas Stern in England and Professor Garnaut in Australia, who did a Stern-like report for Australia, actually in the report said, look, initially we should go for 2 degrees, but we think this might be a bit disruptive to the economy, so let's go for 3 degrees instead. This was Stern's initial report. So you can see when it comes to, is it the climate that's important or is it not rocking the economic boat? The economy and the maintenance of things as they are has taken absolute priority, and that's why we've got into the jam that we have now. And the simple conclusion is that that paradigm no longer works. It's expired. It's run out of time. We had reduced emissions under this paradigm, but we haven't. And now we have to say, as Ban Ki-moon has said, as Al Gore says, we actually now face an emergency. And what do we understand by emergency? It means dropping what we normally do in order to solve an overwhelming problem. We have incredible bushfires here in Australia, which your listeners may have seen last Australian spring. And they think it's actually going to destroy parts of Australia where people can live. And in a bushfire, you don't go about your normal business. You drop everything you do the same with floods, with storms, with cyclones, and you get to work at speed to solve the problem. And I think that's what we've reached now.
Okay, now, just before we get to your proposal of a sort of climate war strategy, I want to mention that Utah scientist Dr. Timothy Garrett calculated in a peer-reviewed paper that only a complete collapse of industrial civilization could prevent a climate catastrophe. Are you calling for a collapse?
This is economic collapse necessary to save ourselves?
Yes.
Well, if we don't act, then that will de facto become the case. There's a former leader of Greenpeace, an Australian called Paul Gilding, wrote a great book 3 years ago called The Great Disruption, which he said for all sorts of reasons, the Club of Rome reasons about limits to growth and running out of resources, he said if we don't act and change the way we're behaving, and he spent a lot of time in the corporate world, he said we will get a collapse, we will get a great disruption, and what we need to do is start to act differently now in order to avoid it. So I don't think it's inevitable, but it's certainly by lack of action where we're heading at the moment.
Now, back in December 2012, you wrote about scientists who backed a war-type footing to address this essential threat. And what are you calling for? Is it a war strategy?
Well, look, I mean, I guess there's a whole lot of analogies we can use. I think what we have to accept is that the paradigm of slow growth, of incremental change, which says we can do this by, you know, a few carbon taxes, a deal here, a deal there. We don't want to upset people. We don't want to affect their standard of living. We don't want anything that's too disruptive to the economy. We can stick within the free market. What we in Australia, perhaps in Canada, would call the neoconservative or neoliberal agenda, can do this. Now, that obviously can't work. We have to reduce emissions really fast now. We've run out of time. And that is essentially going to mean us putting aside a lot of things we normally care about and are our social priorities in order to solve this problem. It means radically reducing our demand for energy, because that's the quickest way to get emissions done. It means changing our whole energy supply system in as fast a period of time as we can. It's going to take a few years to scale up. Some people call it the war economy. Some people call it emergency mode. It doesn't matter the words. It's that sense, and I guess some people look to Britain in 1939-40 when Churchill took over, and in the mid-30s when he was saying, the rise of Germany is a problem, we have to rearm. And they thought he was a nutter, he was a crazy. The government in power said, no, we'll sign a peace deal with Germany, this is all okay. And when Churchill came in, he really did turn things around. In the United States in 1940, defense spending was something like 2% of their economy. In 3 years' time, it was 30%. Now, I don't want all our money to be spent on military equipment, but it's the sort of rapid change, rapid scale-out that we actually physically need now that makes us use those form of words.
Right. The American government said to the auto industry, you're not going to produce another car. And it was a very important part of the economy at that time. You're going to switch over to building parts for tanks and boats and planes.
Absolutely. And we would say to industries, now you're going to stop building this and you're going to start building large-scale solar farms or wind towers, or you're going to start producing electric long-haul train systems and transport systems. I mean, we have incredible industrial capacity. We have incredible financial capacity. I mean, it would be sad if the global financials, the global decision making could save the banks in 2008, but couldn't save the planet. So it's not capacity, it's social and political will, and people will desperately stick to the existing paradigm until it's clear that it can't work. And then I think they will switch. So the work I've done on the end of the carbon budget is just one attempt to demonstrate that this larger, faster scale of action is now necessary. It's the only option because the other option has run out of time.
And how seriously do you take this threat of Arctic methane? We've been talking about a carbon budget and what humans produce, but this is something else, isn't it?
Yes, well, there are two forms of problems in the Arctic. One is what we would know as terrestrial or ground permafrost, which is frozen ground in which is laid down very rich carbon stores, which are frozen and therefore immobile at the moment on land. And as it gets warmer, they will melt and emissions will come up either as methane, if it's anaerobic through water, or as carbon dioxide. The bigger problem is what is called, I shouldn't say bigger, the permafrost has more carbon in it than is in the atmosphere now, so it's a very large problem. But a more striking problem in a way are what are called methane clathrates, which is huge amounts of methane in a frozen form on the bottom of the ocean on the surface layer underneath. It's thought that one of the great extinctions 65, 75 million years ago was produced by a catastrophic release of clathrates, and this is now a very hot topic. We don't have the history to know exactly the conditions when it might happen, but Professor Peter Wadhams from Cambridge, who's one of the leading Arctic experts, says, you know, I think it could happen within a couple of degrees, and has given a very compelling argument. He put out a paper in Nature, which was very controversial, saying 50 billion tonnes of this could come up. Given the amount of warming in the Arctic, given that we've lost three-quarters of sea ice by volume in summer in 20 or 30 years, which must, when there's none of that ice reflecting the sun and the Arctic in summer is a dark, brooding rock and ice mass, Greenland will go. The degree of warming in the Arctic at the moment is 2 to 3 times the global average. It could kick up to 4 times the global average. If it gets hot enough, will those clathrates go? Absolutely. Do we know when? Not yet.
You know, David Spratt, I do get some listener emails who say we shouldn't really always focus on the alarmism, and I do try and put out some solutions, but you've published a little booklet explaining why looking for the bright side in climate change is a mistake. Why do you say that?
Look, we had an experience in Australia where we had a Labor government, I guess what you vaguely call a less than centre government, try to bring in a carbon tax, a price on pollution. In 2010, and the Conservative opposition, what you have in Canada, really mauled them about it and said that they withdraw it. And the government actually got very frightened about talking about climate change because they hadn't done the work, and end up trying to sell this carbon tax by talking about clean energy all the time and never talking about climate change, which I thought was a very bad mistake. And I talked to people in marketing and advertising, and they said, yes, you can't sell an answer unless you explain the problem. They said, if you want to explain and build up support for climate action, they said, your narrative must be science, 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 solution. That is, you explain the problem and then you tell people what the answer is. And we have some very clear data in Australia where we have perhaps the world's leading practice on stopping smoking, on health promotion, very effective campaigning, which has taken advertising out and plain paper packaging now, which has driven down smoking rates a lot, and they say there's always three elements. Explain the problem really brutally, really honestly. Show people what the answer is and show them the efficacious path, the action they can take to get from the problem to the answer. So they'll show you what smoking does to your lungs. They can say, you can stop, and here's the steps you can take to stop. And that path is well established in health promotion. And I think in climate change too, we can't get people to accept radical, strong action without explaining why the problem's so severe. And I think the same thing happened with the Obama administration at the same time. Perhaps the Australian government borrowed from the United States and was a disaster there. And now in the United States, through things like Climate Nexus, they've got back on top of the climate debate with the deniers and started talking about connecting the dots, extreme weather and that sort of thing, and support for climate action has gone up. So I agree we need to talk about the answers. It's absolutely true we need a positive story to tell, but if we don't explain a problem to people, we can't expect them to support the answer to that problem.
All right. Now, I'd like to find out just a little bit more about you on behalf of our listeners. When did you start the Code Red blog and why? And why did you stake out what seemed to be an extreme position at the time and now is becoming more mainstream?
Well, look, I have not been in climate all my life. I'm not a climate scientist. I've actually been involved in other community struggles around peace and justice and so on. And I came to the issue 10 or 11 years ago. When I thought the Stern report was a bit too conservative, and then we had our own Stern report in Australia called Lugano report, and I started writing a submission with a friend of mine to that report. And as I started to write the submission, there was that incredible melting in the Arctic in 2007, which astounded scientists, where they talked about melting being 100 years ahead of schedule. And the more I studied the science, I came to understand that there was a science story which was different from the one that was in the mainstream media. I mean, it's a story that Jim Hansen was telling about feedbacks and 2 degrees being too high, and him saying we're already on the edge of the precipice beyond which there's no redemption. So I did a lot of serious reading in the science, and we also wrote about emergency mode and solutions. And from reading the science, I just tried to write in a book called Climate Code Red, the Case for Emergency Action with Philip Sutton, what I thought the science really meant. And we had a chapter on the Arctic, which I read last week, which really echoed what that research 2 weeks ago has found out to be true. So we weren't scientists. We could be slightly speculative. But I have to say, most of the things we wrote in that book that people thought we've perhaps gone a bit on the edge on, in the last 6 years, have largely proved to be correct. So the book was not too radical. The book has really, in terms of its size, I think, become much more mainstream, sadly, because it's at the difficult end of impacts happening more quickly and at lower temperatures than were previously expected.
We're just about out of time, but I want to ask, is there a particular theme or idea that is occupying your mind now, something that you're developing?
Well, look, I think that the most recent posting I did, which is on this carbon budget, really is the thing I've spent a bit of time on. They can find it on the website, climatecodered.org. The posting is called The Real Budgetary Emergency and the Myth of Burnable Carbon. And ever since the IPCC report came out, I've been concerned that the understanding of the carbon budget wasn't really there, and there were headlines saying we've got half the budget left to burn, and I could see that we didn't. So I think recent science, this work in the Antarctic, shows us that things are happening much more quickly. So that's one thing. The other thing is this failure of the international process, and you bring those two together and it's time to say we need a paradigm shift. We have to think differently about how we're going to solve this problem by really devoting much more of our society's resources to it, because that's the inevitable situation we've reached in this clash between politics and science.
It is a Code Red. We've been speaking with Australian climate blogger, author, and activist David Spratt. Find his work at climatecodered.org, and I suggest you check that regularly. You'll find not just voices from Australia, but around the world that mainstream media seldom publish. David, thank you for helping us out this time on Radio EcoShock.
My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith. Find links to the articles and issues we've just talked about in my Radio EcoShock show blog at ecoshock.info. That's published every Wednesday.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. We saw it in Hurricane Sandy. Parts of Manhattan were flooded, including streets, subways, and buildings. Expect a lot more of that as sea levels rise. But you won't have to wait a century to find more flooding in America's greatest city. Quoting from a new study, 3 of the 9 highest recorded water levels in New York Harbor region have occurred since 2010. A recent scientific letter suggests the odds of storm tides overflowing seawalls in New York City have increased 20-fold since the mid-1800s. Dr. Stefan Talke has a PhD in civil and environmental engineering. He studied the way sediments work in rivers and estuaries in Europe and on the Pacific coast, and that's where he teaches at Portland State University. Along with scientists Philip Orton and David Jay, Stefan Talke just published the startling findings about New York City flooding in the journal Geophysical Research Letters. Dr. Talke, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
3 of the highest levels since 2010. Apparently, it wasn't just Hurricane Sandy. Can you tell us about recent high waters in the Big Apple?
Well, as most people know or suspect, the increase in the high waters is being driven by sea level rise. If you look at data that NOAA has prepared, since the mid-1800s, there's been about 45 centimeters or a foot and a half of sea level rise in New York City. About half of that is being driven by subsidence. So the New York is sinking, and the other half is being driven by global sea level rise and also by local oceanographic processes. What we did is find out that another reason is that storm tides are increasing. So a storm tide is basically the sum of the daily tide plus the storm surge that's being forced by wind from a storm. So if you put those two together, that's you get your storm tide. And we recently found data extending back to 1844, and we recovered that in the U.S. National Archives. And when we digitized that, so basically I had students enter the data, and then I analyzed it. When we did that, we found that not only is the sea level rising, but on top of that, the storm tides are getting larger. So the once in 10-year event, or rather the event that has a 10% probability of happening every year, that has increased by also nearly a foot since the mid-1800s.
Now, just as an aside, why is New York City sinking? Is it the weight of the buildings or the way people flatten out the earth or what?
Well, it's just generally on that part of the East Coast. What happened is that in the last ice age, there was a big mass of ice to the north of New York City, and that tended to press the land there down. And then when the ice receded, that part of the country is actually raising. New York was not covered by ice, but you can think of it in analogy with a footstep, right? If you step on mud, the mud sinks down, but around your footprint, the earth actually rises up. And then when you take your foot off, then you have some rebound where your footprint was, but around that area, the mud level will actually sink. And so that's what's happening on a really large scale, is you had a big ice footprint that in some places in the northern locales pushed the land down, and so that's rebounding. But then in front of that, you have areas which were pushed up by the ice and now are sinking. So, you know, that's the origin of a big problem for the whole East Coast, or for many parts of the East Coast, is that even if you didn't have sea level rise, the coastal areas would be sinking and would eventually have issues. And global warming or global sea level rise is just accelerating that process.
And I was reading through your paper, and I see you had to take into account another cycle, and that's something called the North Atlantic Oscillation. Can you briefly explain what that is for us?
Yeah, so it's a long-term weather pattern over the North Atlantic. And basically what it is it's the atmospheric pressure gradient between the Azores Island, which are in the middle of the Atlantic, more or less due east of New York, and Iceland. And during some periods of time, this gradient, the pressure difference between the atmospheric pressure difference between the Azores and Reykjavik, or Iceland, is large, and in some periods it's small, or it's smaller than usual. And this affects weather all over the North Atlantic. In some phases, you have dry and cold winters in Europe, and in other phases, you have in Northern Europe, in other phases, you have warm and wet winters in Northern Europe. And so there's a cyclicity that happens, and it can happen. It happens on the monthly scale, and it happens also on the decadal scale, so over decades. And what we found is that this climate fluctuation also appears to influence the storm surge and the storm tides in New York. And so in times where this pressure gradient or the difference in pressure between those two locations is less than normal, you tend to get greater storm tides happening in New York, and vice versa, of course. And so what it means is that there's some periods where you have more variance in your storms and that leads to larger overall levels.
And where are we now in that cycle?
You know, it's hard to tell exactly right now. And there are some indications that this cycle is being affected by the melting of the ice sheets, for example. I don't know enough about that to really make a prediction. But historically, if you look at the data, there was a period during, say, from about 1950 to about 1970, where the NAO index, so that's basically a way of looking at this pressure difference, when it was less than usual during this particular period, during the 1950s and 60s. And we saw many strong storm tides in New York, such as Hurricane Donna. During the following 20 or so years, it switched, and you didn't see as many storms, statistically speaking, as large storms, statistically speaking, as you saw in the previous period. And now it seems to be ticking up again, but it's hard to tell because you know, you kind of have to wait and see what will happen.
Right. It's easier to see in retrospect than it is to try and predict where we are right now. So for New Yorkers trying to keep their feet and their buildings dry, it is the storm surge that matters most. Has that risen?
The storm surge itself seems to have risen based on the analysis that we did. And the storm tides have as well. And there's a little bit of a distinction there because the storm tides are the sum of both the tides and the surge. So that it could be that the tides are changing as well, or that the interaction between the surge and the tides is changing. And by interaction, basically, I mean, you have to think when there's a surge and when there's a tide, it has to get into and out of the harbor. And so local effects can be very important. And also, you know, if the tide is going out when the surge is coming in, you'll have a little bit different behavior than if the opposite is true. And so what we see, if we look at the long-term tidal record, is we see evidence of continual perturbation in the tides. And it's not a really large signal, but it's definitely there. And what it suggests is that there's been continual development of New York Harbor over the last 150 years. There's been dredging, there's been deepening of channels, there's been reclamation of wetlands, and all this changes the volume of the bay, but also changes the effect, the frictional effect. It's kind of like, you know, if you drive a VW bus, you'll have a different frictional drag than if you're driving a Porsche. And what we have done is we've taken an estuary or in a harbor, which had many roughness elements, you know, was maybe more like a VW bus, and we've streamlined it. We've made it easier for the water to move into and out of the harbor. And you can see this if you do the same sort of tidal analysis that gets used to predict the tides. You know, so one of the hypotheses that we have is that part of the reason why storm tides or the water levels are increasing during storms is that it just is becoming easier for the water to enter New York Harbor.
That makes total sense. And, you know, the loss of wetlands was also a factor possibly in Hurricane Katrina and the flooding there, as we know. This is Radio EcoShock with Dr. Stefan Talca as our guest. We are talking about the growing risks of flooding in New York City. So was the storm surge of Hurricane Sandy really the high water mark for the New York City region, or were there even greater whoppers in the past 150 years?
That's a really good question. And from what we've been able to figure out, just looking at the historical record, is that Hurricane Sandy is the largest water level that has been measured. However, if you go back 190 years to 1821, it appears like there was a storm in which, even though the water level was not as high as Hurricane Sandy, the actual storm surge was higher. And it just happened that it reached New York exactly at low tide. So if Hurricane Sandy, if that had happened at low tide rather than high tide, the flooding would have been much less than it was. So part of the reason why Hurricane Sandy was bad is that, you know, on top of having a storm surge of 2.8 meters or so, you also had it occurring right at high tide at, you know, of 0.6 or 0.7 meters. And so it was a combined effect that really made Hurricane Sandy so bad. In 1821, the indications are that the storm surge was probably higher, but that's a little bit lost in history. All we have is newspaper accounts that suggest that it was really high. And we also have indications from wind and barometric pressure and so on that it was perhaps something similar to a hurricane of strength 2 or 3. But that's still something that I think we can, you know, with modern numerical modeling, we can try to get a better estimate of what that particular storm was.
Okay, well, now here is one sentence from a press summary of your work that really caught my attention, namely the changes in sea level and storm surge have, quote, magnified the annual probability of overtopping the typical Manhattan seawall from less than 1% to about 20 to 25%, and that's the annual probability. Can you explain what that means for people living there?
Yeah, so what we did is we used a nominal height for a typical seawall level in Manhattan. And we chose 1.75 meter based on some work that has been done by another scientist. And when you use this particular level and you do a statistical analysis of the data from the 1800s, which we have back to 1844, and you do the same analysis on the modern data, what you find is that, just as you said, you have a very large increase in the probability of 1.75 meters being reached. And that's both due to sea level rise, but also this increase in the storm tides that we've been discussing. Now, there's some confusion about what that, there could possibly be some confusion of what that exactly means. You know, overtopping 1.75 meters doesn't mean that there's going to be catastrophic flooding in New York. It just means that the storm tide or the storm surge will reach that level. But for flooding to occur, you need to have sustained water levels over that level. You know, things like the height of the waves also matter. And it also has to be said that there are many places in which the seawalls in Manhattan are actually higher than 1.75 meters. Or, you know, the land behind it is higher than 1.75 meters. So you have a real, it's not the same as saying flood risk. However, it's an indicator of how much the risk is changing over time. And if this is a trend that's going to continue in time, then definitely, you know, that has severe implications for New York Harbor. And that's why it's important that we figure out exactly what are the reasons for this observed increase. Is it something local? Is it just due to, you know, reclaiming wetlands and deepening for shipping and changing the plumbing of New York, so to say? Or is it being driven by climatic changes in the North Atlantic? And I think, you know, both the solutions and what to do about it will shift depending on the answer. If it's something local and that happened once and things are not and it's not going to change anymore, then that's one thing. But if it's being driven by some sort of storminess in the North Atlantic, then we definitely want to get a handle on what is causing that.
You know, shortly after Hurricane Sandy, I interviewed Professor J. Court Stevenson from the University of Maryland. He looked at coastal defenses around the world and suggested for a mere $10 billion, New York Harbor could install 3 storm surge gates that it requires. Do you have any opinion on how effective such defensive projects could be?
You know, I haven't looked closely at that particular issue. I do know that, you know, that in the Netherlands, they have an extensive system of storm surge barriers, but they've also linked that with increasing the height of the levees. You know, I think that's the example that probably should be studied to figure out whether it's a cost-effective means of doing that, of controlling, you know, extreme water levels. I think, you know, if you're looking at the extreme projections of sea level rise, there probably need to be, or it's quite possible that a storm surge barrier could be needed. But again, I haven't really looked at that issue. And I think that's a discussion that needs to happen over the next years.
Well, I'll offer you and the listeners my opinion on that, and it's just an uneducated opinion, and that is that streets are starting to flood in low-lying parts of cities around the world. Miami's one of them, and New York's constantly going to have to fend that off. Now, if you could spend tens of billions of dollars and keep, you know, a trillion-dollar institution like Manhattan going, well, I guess that would be worth it, but eventually, you know, perhaps 200 years from now, I think we're going to have to retreat from the sea due to climate change and rising seas. But I'd like to move on. I'm also interested in your work in the way humans influence sediments, leading to an increase in dead zones. Can you explain that relationship for us?
Yeah, well, this was work that I did some years ago in an estuary on the North Sea between the Netherlands and Germany. And basically what had been done there has been repeated in many other estuaries, and that is that the estuary was deepened. So in other words, in this particular estuary, there was there's a town called Papenburg, which makes really large cruise ships. And it was necessary for that industry to continue to make the river deeper than it wanted to be, essentially. And by deepening the river, it ended up drastically changing the tides. So in fact, if you look at data that I've uncovered from the 1800s and you look at the data from now, you find that in the upstream portions of this river, the tide range has increased by 10 feet or so just in the last 100 years. And even in the last 20 years, there's been a big increase. And what that has done is it's essentially made a better sediment trap. So the sediment gets pumped in from the ocean by tidal processes and density currents, because there's density currents that get set up from, you have salt water on one hand and fresh water on the other, and the dense water goes underneath the fresh water and sets up a circulation. Well, that circulation brings in the sediment as well. And there's other things that are going on with the tides that create the same sort of process. And so what you end up doing is you end up collecting just loads and loads of sediment, and it never escapes. And the sediment has some biological oxygen demand, which is to say just organic material which consumes oxygen. So bacteria and so on that are just consuming oxygen. And so they've basically gone in this particular river from having a pristine, not pristine conditions, but even 25 years ago, there's stories of seals following the boats up the river and fishing and so on. Now that's all gone. There's just a very large dead zone of low oxygen water that gets produced in the summertime when the water temperatures increase. And it's really directly related to the changes that have been made. Now, most estuaries are not as sensitive as this estuary is. But there is one famous one which I hypothesize was influenced by the same problem, and that's the Thames estuary in England. And everyone probably knows the nursery rhyme, London Bridge is Falling Down. And what's interesting is to wonder or to speculate, why was it falling down? And it turns out, if you look at Roman records, the tides in the Thames estuary were perhaps 1 meter or a yard. The tidal range was maybe a meter 2,000 years ago. And 200 years ago, it had become 6 meters, so 20 feet, or much, much larger. And the reason I hypothesize is the same reason that is the same thing that happened on the Ems, which is a very large increase in the tides, which led to increase in currents, which led to erosion around the bridge. And that's why it was falling down. And so you can see that in estuaries and harbors, that there is the possibility of drastically changing the way things work. And that's part of the reason why I think it's not inconceivable that at least some of the change in New York is driven by local anthropogenic processes rather than the climate. Although the climate is quite probable that that's having an influence as well.
Well, as an aside of trivia, I believe they rebuilt the London Bridge in Arizona. Now, As we wrap up, I wanted to ask you one last thing. Your doctorate work studied those processes in San Francisco Bay, and we have a lot of listeners there. How is the health of the bay?
That's hard for me to address, you know, because I haven't worked there for a while, and I haven't looked at the health holistically. One of the interesting things that's been happening in San Francisco Bay recently, though, is that it actually seems to be getting cleaner, or that rather the water is becoming less turbid. And this happened about 15 years ago after the last big El Nino floods in 1998. It seemed to push the last of the sediment from the gold rush out of the system. And now measurements by the USGS, by a colleague there, show that sediment concentrations have actually gone very far down. And this is potentially a problem because it means that there'll be more erosion, in theory at least, in some parts of the bay which have contaminated sediments. But that remains to be seen. I mean, my impression generally, and this is a non-scientific assessment, is that we're generally doing better in terms of what we're putting into estuaries. You know, the EPA laws and so on have had their effect. But there's still a lot of legacy contaminants in many estuaries and harbors. And, you know, that's a long-term problem.
We'll have to leave it there. This is Radio EcoShock. We've been talking with Dr. Stefan Talca from Portland State University. He's the lead author of a piece in Geophysical Research Letters titled Increasing Storm Tides in New York Harbor, 1844 to 2013. Find more links about this discussion in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Stefan, thank you so much for talking with us and doing what you do.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. We've all been wondering how to survive in a heat-stressed world. Here is the audio from the best short YouTube video I've found on that. It's by Marjorie Wildcraft, recorded in a garden farmyard in Texas during their incredible drought and heat wave 3 years ago. Listen and learn, Grasshopper.
Hi, I'm Marjorie Wildcraft, and back to my garden, and today we're going to be talking about survival gardening in the heat. We're here in central Texas. Right now, it's about 60 days that we've had that are over 100 degrees. And let's talk about how you would possibly grow food under these kind of conditions. And first of all, I've done a lot of interviews with older Texans in their 70s and 80s and asked them what it was like, especially if they lived in rural environments. And a large majority of them were not gardening at this time of the month, and at this time of year. This is August right now. Most of them got their gardens in March and were working them and had everything harvested and processed and canned and done up by mid-June, July at the latest. And they weren't out here at this time trying to be involved in this. They'd go back into, they might be starting seeds, but they would not be back into the gardens until September to get things going again for the fall garden. So the very first thing is don't garden in this heat if you don't have to. But we're talking about survival gardening, and you may need to be out here trying to grow food at this time. And so what are some of the things that you can do? The most classic and well-known foods that you can grow that do well in heat and drought and tough environments like this are black-eyed peas, okra, and also sweet potatoes. And actually, sweet potatoes do really well when they're slightly stressed and they grow bigger tubers. So these three foods, the black-eyed peas and the sweet potatoes especially, have a lot of caloric value. And then the okra, of course, is a nice green that will have some more nutritional content for you. But I also today want to talk about three other plants and crops that you might not have considered that are doing well in this kind of conditions and in this kind of heat. And the first one I'm going to talk about are lamb's quarters. So this is a lamb's quarters bush. This is typically about the size it grows, and it's a common weed throughout the United States. It does seem to like a lot more fertility, and often you'll see it, especially if you have an area where your chicken manure has been piling up for a while. The chickens love to eat the seeds that this produces. One of the wonderful things about this, clearly has a good time, is not at all been fazed by even the 108 degree days that we've had. And that's 108 real degrees, not any kind of index. That's what the temperature was. It's a fresh green. It's very tasty. You can either eat it raw or you can cook it like a spinach. Unbelievably high in calcium and a lot of other nutrients. It's a really great plant. This is not going to be huge for calories, but it's a very good vegetable and nutritional plant. Grows super well, and then you can also collect the seeds and save the seeds, use them to grind them up and add to breads or soups or stews for more nutritional content. And really, even just one or two of these is enough for a family of four, say, and growing some more and possibly drying the leaves that later on that you could dry and grind and use as a flour, or just add them to soups or stews for that extra nutritional boost. Very, very useful plant. And it's probably already growing as a weed in your garden right now. Also doesn't require very much water. So this is lamb's quarters. And I highly recommend using this plant in a survival summer garden. Next, we'll move on to a plant you probably haven't heard of. It's called nutsedge. Now, this is another plant you probably heard about if you grow a lawn and you think of it as a weed. It's called nutsedge. And I first heard about this when I was at the farm and garden store, and I was looking for some feed for the wildlife. And they sell this as a crop for wild turkeys, to attract wild turkeys. What this, and they call it chufa. What happens is this plant makes small little nuts on its root nodules. They're, you know, about the size of a pea or about the size of your pinky. And they're actually very delicious little nuts. And this particular species has been grown. It's still very close to its wild cousins, and it's a plant that's generally a weed and very difficult to get rid of. Those are the kind of plants that you want to find and use, because this means this thing can tolerate the heat and it can tolerate whatever climatic changes that are coming at with us. Now, I have not a whole lot of experience growing this, but my understanding is that it's about 3 months to maturity, where you would dig this up and then dig up all those little nuts. I have eaten the nuts, and they are very kind of sweet and nutty tasting, and actually a surprising amount of calories. So this is nutsedge, and want to bring that to your attention as another possibility for survival gardening in the heat. Doesn't really require much care. The next thing we're going to go to, and you might not have thought about this one, is a canna lily. All right, this is a canna lily plant, and actually a neighbor gave this to me. She gave me some of the tubers, and she said, "Hey, Marjorie, this is a great plant. It survives anything." Whenever anybody says that, I get excited. You know, great, I want a plant that survives. She says, "Really not good for anything. It makes these beautiful blooms." Now, this it does make these beautiful blooms, and this is actually not as well as it could be doing. This plant, in better years, is often, you know, 6 or 8 feet tall with these magnificent blooms everywhere. But I got to doing some research, and she's right. It does grow really well with a minimal amount of care. It does like water if it can get it. But when it doesn't, as you can see, it's obviously surviving pretty well. I did some research on this, and while this particular variety is more focused on developing beautiful flowers, it turns out that the roots that it makes and the rhizomes, like a tuber, are edible. And it's a nice starch. It's kind of like a cross between a potato and a water chestnut. But a very simple plain starch. You can make big chunks of it like a potato and add it to soups and stews. The real value of this plant that I really like is it survives and it does well in this crazy weather and in the dry periods. And then when it gets a chance in a wet period, it'll just go crazy and explode, and you'll get a huge amount of food production just from digging up the roots and the tubers. This again is going to be a plant that will die back in the winter. So I won't be messing with its tubers too much there, but you almost can't kill it. You almost can't dig up all the tubers and not have it come back the next year and grow back a whole nother crop for you. But anyway, this is a canna lily, and it's available as an ornamental, and it's also available as where they've developed it more for a food source. As you may know, I'm very interested in food sources that I don't have to do much work for. And so these, you just plant them in the ground and leave them there, and then come dig out the extra tubers around the edge as they grow them, and then leave a core base of tubers to continue to regrow and resprout. And in tough years like this, it survives. You'll get a little bit. In years when you've got a lot of rain, you're going to get a lot of food production, and it'll be really easy. So there's some great tips and suggestions for alternative food sources that you might not have thought about for growing and survival gardening in intense heat. This is Marjorie Wildcraft, and we'll see you on another video.
That wise advice came from Marjorie Wildcraft at marjoriewildcraft.com. It's called Gardening in the Heat, posted on YouTube in November 2011. Find links to Marjorie and the video in my show blog at ecoshock.info, and check out her influential DVD called Grow Your Own Groceries. I'm going to ask Marjorie to join us on the program. That is our show for this week, from One Species in Trouble on the Living Planet. Get more from the show blog at ecoshock.info, past programs free from the website at ecoshock.org, and encourage your friends to listen on the Radio EcoShock SoundCloud page. Thank you for listening and caring about your world.